Hey there, this is Paul Roberts of the Security Ledger. If security and the Internet of Things are your thing, I wanted to let you know about a great event Security Ledger is hosting on June 19th in Boston. It's the fifth Security of Things Forum. It's a full day of great content on securing the Internet of Things. If you're interested in learning more or attending the forum, point your web browser to the event website, securityofthings.com, to learn more or to register. Hello and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode of the podcast, number 96, if you think misleading political ads on Facebook are a problem, just wait. The advent of super realistic deepfake videos and audio could have all of us questioning the nature of reality itself. But first, the 2018 election season is well underway with primary elections in states across the U.S. that have gone off so far without incident. However, the votes in November that will determine the control of the U.S. House and Senate, governorships, and control of state legislatures are another matter entirely, and there's deep concern about a repeat of the 2016 presidential election in which disinformation campaigns and other nefarious actions by groups affiliated with the government of Russia are believed to have played a part. Our first guest, John Dixon, a principal at the Denham Group, said that the November midterm elections this year are likely to be a warm-up act for the real show, the 2020 presidential contest. In this conversation, Dixon talks about his work with state elections officials and about the lopsided battle that's shaping up. On the one hand, sophisticated cyber adversaries working for Russia's FSB or other groups, and on the other, state elections officials in some 9,000 jurisdictions without much experience fighting advanced persistent threats.
John Dixon, I'm a principal at Denham Group. There is an onus of responsibility that lies on the shoulders of 50 secretaries of state, and then also, I guess, the DC and Puerto Rican administrator, that they feel is 100% on them.
Yeah.
That whatever GAO and DHS and all the different federal groups do to share information, provide tools, to provide, you know, whatever they can, resources, come November, or I should say come December, after November, the ultimate responsibility is on those secretaries of state. Those are where, that's where the buck stops. You know, if there is one state where there is a interesting thing that happens in the midterm elections, and it comes to, you know, comes to be found out that there was, you know, nation state involvement and or the equivalent of a breach, it'll be the secretary of state of that state who is held accountable, not anybody at DHS, not anybody at GAO, not a member of Congress. So that is the starting point for this discussion, I think. The challenge again now is that you have a nation state, a monolithic nation state in the form of Russia, going after individual U.S. states. That is really the other big key point to think about, is you have a what I call force mismatch or a threat mismatch. It is a fair fight between the Russian government and the U.S. military, U.S. government, and the agencies of the government, typically, nation state to nation state. It is a force mismatch when you have the Russian state going after the Secretary of State in North Dakota. I mean, that is just not a fair fight. And so that is the challenge. And there's, I think, 9,000 entities that administer elections. The Secretaries of State, all the counties, and in certain instances, municipalities, but that there's 9,000 entities that administer elections in some form or fashion, that now these administrators have find themselves on the front line of this particular, I hate the term cyber war, whatever you want to call it, this kerfuffle between the Russians and us. They are absolutely on the front line of that.
Yeah, I know when we reported on this podcast about a tabletop exercise that the Belfer Center at Harvard University did a few weeks back, where I think the Indiana Secretary of State was there, and I think the actual Secretary of State from one other state, and then, of course, representatives from maybe 20 other states, kind of walking through some potential attack scenarios and so on. But yes, these are offices that have not been in the crosshairs, so to speak, of advanced cyber criminals or nation state actors previously. And so my guess is, and you know, because you've been talking to them, there maybe has been a lack of attentiveness to cybersecurity issues, but that is changing. What are they? What are they? You've been talking to these folks at the grassroots level, at the local level. What types of steps have they taken within the last year or so to shore up the security of their systems?
I would say, well, let me just step back and then answer your question by saying the focus of election administrators, election judges, local and state, has always been the integrity of the vote count, the tabulation of the vote count. That is a, believe it or not, fairly straightforward function. Can dead people vote? Yes or no? Can people manipulate votes at the polling site? Yes or no? So it's been the focus on the integrity of the vote count, what they call tabulation. And that's a high bar. In order to inject an effect and tip the balance of the scale from a vote count standpoint, that is a hard thing to do because of the heterogeneity and diversity of voting systems, of the hardware. But what is easier to do is to undermine confidence in the system by doing a series of things. What I see happening at the state and local level is now a consensus opinion that, yes, this is important, transitioning to how do we fund this? And the $380 million that was allocated by the U.S. government helps. But to give you some sense of how big a challenge this is, the hardware aspect alone represents billions and billions of dollars. I did the math in our home state of Texas. There are 254 counties in the state of Texas, which is obviously one of the largest states out there. But 254 counties, and the county that I live in called Bear, which is in San Antonio, there are roughly a little bit over 600 precincts. And on a typical voting day, you're going to have 300 odd voting sites. And in those voting sites, you're going to have anywhere from 6 to 10 voting machines. So you're talking thousands and thousands of thousands of devices. Now, the interesting thing is because there's multiple vendors, many of them are antiquated, many of them are not connected to the internet. In a weird way, we have...
That's secure.
I said we'd stolen one from the Soviet era, which...
Yeah.
If you remember the old... The Russian Soviets were, you know, a little bit more protected from EMP because they didn't have transistors in most of the electronics. They had old tubes and such. Right. In a weird way, that has flipped around where not only are they harder to hack in certain instances, if you're an attacker, putting someone in harm's way to do a physical attack and be physically, in place to do it is not worth it when there's so many other easier ways to do it remotely. That's why I say last year at DEF CON, they hacked 6 different voting machines in person with USB keys. And the one thing I've said over and over, that's such an unrealistic attack, obviously. The one thing election judges can do is they can certainly detect kids in hoodies trying to, you know, mess around with the USB keys and mess around with voting stations. So, like, to do a physical attack, you've actually got observers. And, mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, infrastructure is there for maybe a day or two, but it's watched by 2 people, you know, mm-hmm. Like your ability to walk in and to prosecute attack, or maybe to go into the storage facility and do that attack when the machines are not in use. It's just a harder attack and not worth it when you can go after more centralized assets in the voting system. So, you know, one thing I would say, it's not about vote tabulation. It's not about the hardware. It is really about all the interconnecting systems and the systems of permanence, i.e. the voter registration and reporting infrastructures.
By messing with the voter rolls and causing confusion and therefore long lines and delays at, you know, again, certain precincts, right? Because we know the Russians have a very granular understanding of what counties matter and what counties don't matter in a swing election. So they don't need to do it everywhere. They need to just do it where it really matters. They could have the same effect as trying to hack into and change votes on a bunch of different systems.
It's easier. Right. You said precincts. You used the plural term precincts. I would say precinct. Pick one precinct. Right. Do it to one precinct.
Right.
And then use all your bot army to go out and put it on Facebook and Twitter and whatever and have the leveraged effect of saying, look, this happened in Broward County, or this happened in Cook County, or this happened in Bear County. And then like social media. I mean, the thing to remember, and you know this, is that the one thing that the Russians are better at than cyber is espionage, deception, and disinformation. So those technically, those are three different things, but you get my drift. They're much better at information warfare.
Broadly, you know, information ops, yeah.
You know, in the discussions with these, you know, with these secretaries of state, I mean, you're starting to talk about nation state threats and like having to be savvy about manipulation of the press and social media. You're asking them to go from one world, which is a 1950s world of, you know, vote tabulation and counting, a very kind of Norman Rockwell kind of way, to cyber war and thinking about an information warfare, thinking about deception and how I would manipulate the, you know, the entire confidence in the system.
Okay, so if you're advising local governments about how they should address that particular risk, what would you recommend? You know, again, looking for those types of attacks, the messing with the voting rolls, denial of service attacks to cripple the website announcing the election result. What's the recommendation from John?
Number one, some basic blocking and tackle security stuff around making sure you're election officials, particularly the leadership and secretary of states, have things like two-factor auth, rigorous phishing training, rigorous training around how to detect social engineering, because that's the other thing with the Russians. They're always going to have a social engineering component. I will tell you, in my conversations with state officials in multiple states, they get it. They understand it. The question is, what do they do and in what order and how quickly? And what I'm saying is, at least, you know, do the classic security assessment. What are your critical assets? Make sure those are secure. Know what your attack surface is. Limit your attack surface and then go from there.
You know, we've been talking about, oh, well, the Russians are smart, so they know that they don't need to target an entire state. They can actually focus on one or two critical precincts. Let's say, you know, an urban area, right, where you've got a couple precincts that account for a huge percentage of the vote total and maybe particularly for one party versus another. Do you get the sense that secretaries of state understand that as well and that they are doing what we would call a risk-based assessment and saying, I don't have to apply the same amount of attentiveness uniformly across all these precincts because here's the four or five that I know the Russians are going to be interested in and I should concentrate my resources there and my firepower there?
I would say they're getting there. Some are further ahead than others. Again, there's 50 snowflakes out there. I think the bigger states that have more resources are probably further along in that regard. But again, they are shifting from, again, an integrity and tabulation focus to an information warfare resiliency focus, and that's going to be hard to do. The one thing that I will tell you that they are very good at is virtually all of them either appointed or elected. They're political officials who have one foot in the administrative world and they have one foot in the political world, which is actually a good thing because what they don't want to have happen is have an election thrown on their watch. And so they don't want to be that guy. They don't want to be the John Podesta. They don't want to be the hanging Chad. So I view 2018 as a, you know, kind of a test case or as a tune-up preseason for 2020. And, you know, the Russians are emboldened because they've had success. They got away with it. And there hasn't been the uniform response from democracies, not only us, but other democracies, until they get caught with their hands in the cookie jar, it'll continue. And there's no reciprocity, right? I mean, like, what are we going to do? Go and manipulate their fraudulent elections? You know, like, there's nothing we can do back to them in that regard, except to do things like ban their oligarchs or try to hit them economically. And so that's the challenge. Like, there's no reciprocity.
The Department of Homeland Security has put together a task force to help states and localities. I think there are about 10 or 15 people just working full time on this. I don't know. It doesn't sound like that many to me. But do you get a sense that that's making a difference?
It's starting to. And I encourage every state to consume as much of what DHS is producing as possible. What I worry is that the DHS guys have one solution. They're going to roll out a DHS solution, and it'll be consumed by many. But because there's 50 different snowflakes out there, that they really have to do a self-assessment and a technical assessment that is done from the perspective of a nation-state threat, a realistic and very rigorous assessment to validate whatever their attack surface is, and versus like having DHS come in and run, you know, a one-size-fits-all vulnerability scan. That's probably not fair to DHS, but I do, and their heart's in the right place. The challenge is that, and what I've found is that each of the states are wildly different. Like the small states have some commonalities. The bigger states have some things in common, but there's stuff all the way in between. And again, some are more centralized. Texas is not centralized. 254 counties. I mean, just imagine how staggering that is.
We have 14 in Massachusetts.
Yeah, 14. We have two time zones. Like El Paso's in a different time zone. So just the physical, you know, the Secretary of State, I think, in our state, and the headcount probably is bigger than many states combined. And same thing with California. If you were to look at the challenges that California, Texas, New York, Florida have, there are certain types of problems the bigger states have. There's certain types of problems the medium-sized states have. And then there's certain sets of problems that are probably very similar that the North Dakotas and South Dakotas and Rhode Islands have that are unique. And again, the smaller you get, the more centralized those functions usually are. And in a way, there's some strength there in that there's familiarity and they know everybody. They're not very large bureaucracies or organizations. But they have all implemented voter systems differently. And in many states, they have different hardware throughout the different counties. Again, that's hard from an administrative standpoint. It makes a weird situation where that's actually a little bit more secure because of the, you know, diverse nature of all their voting machines. So that's why I've said over and over, focus on the, you know, kind of the choke points of voting, of registration, you know, the way that the registration works with the different to validate data with most of the state DMVs. Those are usually fairly different. They're all takes a level of mindfulness and understanding to dissect where the risks are. The common denominators of voter registration and reporting present attractive targets. And then I think also you throw in the ability to use one precinct or one state, particularly in the East Coast, if you're talking presidential elections. I mean, like you can, if I were a bad guy, I would focus everything in the eastern side because you can affect the states every time zone west of that. You know, this idea of building resiliency and being able to respond, I think as we get closer to 2020, areas of resilience and reporting, and assuming this is going to happen, and assuming we have to have essentially what the campaigns do. The campaigns have this rapid reaction cell. I mean, I think the DNCCC and the RNCCC and the presidential campaigns always have this these cells that rapidly respond to news so that they don't get so that a bad news article doesn't come out and doesn't get responded to within the same news cycle. I think we have to apply that same thought to the confidence in the election system. And that could be something that happened at the federal level, but at a minimum has to happen. You know, as soon as you see this stuff, you have to respond because two news cycles later, it's fact.
You know, obviously with 2016, a lot of people were caught unawares, I think, even at a high level, about the capabilities of nation state actors and how vulnerable the election system was. Will we have, when the midterms come up in November, will we have learned some of the lessons of that and be better prepared, better, more ready for possibilities of intrusion?
Look at it this way. I think there has been a sea change of viewing the roles of these secretaries of state. They get it, right? The question is how quickly and how fast. I think they are moving in that direction. They'll start to see certain positive things happen in 2016. But again, the technical debt and the challenge is enormous across mm-hmm. the United States. So that's where taking that $380 million and making it count immediately to shore up the most, you know, ridiculous things. That's where I'm recommending the Secretary of State's focus is really triage, mm-hmm. upping their game around monitoring, understanding what badness looks like. and being prepared. And I think that is going to take an election or two, but I do think the world has changed. And again, think of it this way. Who would have thought an election administrator in so-and-so county or so-and-so state would be on the front lines of this stuff? And I think they will get better. The question is really, will they get better? What will the Russians do? I suspect the Russians will do stuff differently. I do think the DDoS thing is one that is worrisome because it's so easy to do. I'm advising that secretaries of state really, really focus on DDoS protection and infrastructure on reporting in election nights and having secondary, tertiary fallback ways. And most of them do, but to do that in a way and have a response cell so that if they do get DDoS, yep, we're getting DDoS. You know, welcome to the real world. We're doing this.
Yeah,
we haven't missed beats. I mean, adopting what the military and the banks have started to do, which is like, we just have to fight through this. Yep, we're going to get DDoS. Yep,
yeah,
we're gonna
happen. Right.
Yeah, we're going to happen. It's part of the reality.
Mission continuity, right?
Yeah. I mean, like, it's how quickly do they detect and respond and how resilient are they? Yes, we're going to be operating in a degraded mode, but this is what we're going to do to react to it and blah, blah, blah. You know, like it's the fact that they anticipated certain types of threats and attacks and they responded to those and they played through the pain.
Yeah.
That's what I hope we end up at some point. And I do think certain states are probably further ahead than others is what I suspect.
Yeah, what's amazing is that, you know, we live in such a partisan time, and I think people look at this stuff very cynically. I think when you talk to these secretaries of state, you realize how personally they take the security of the election, regardless of what their party is and regardless of whether the outcome favors their party or not. It's like they really look at this completely independent of that, and they are very, very invested in having elections that have a high degree of integrity. And it's almost like it's personal for them. And if our democracy survives these hacking attempts, it will basically be because of these very uncolorful kind of bureaucrats who are working within secretaries of state's office.
I could not agree more. I would say people in the smaller states that are in, you know, like that are in these roles of election administrators are now in a new world. And
yeah.
I do believe in my conversations with them that they do fully recognize what is happening. But as it's just kicked up a ton of questions of strategy and of technology that like the financial service guys have been able to address and assimilate for the last 20 plus years. They're getting all that in Technicolor right now, all at the same time, in the span of 1 year. So imagine that. And
It's crazy.
They're going from election administrators to, you know, for lack of a better, cyber warriors. You know, I had the opportunity to go to one state capitol yesterday and meet with the Secretary of State. And there's a component of business there, fully acknowledged, but really I think it's more the spiritual part of the security guy thing. It's like, oh my gosh, man, partisanship aside, this is something that we should be able to help, you know, our secretaries of state with, because there is a huge learning curve. And you're right. Like, I feel like I'll be damned if I'll let the Russians do this in our backyard or our state. So this might actually be a pretty cool little call to action for security folks is like, you know, maybe volunteer and be an election judge or go volunteer at your local county to help them out or augment what they're doing. There are many counties that don't have IT people that are helping assist, you know, they certainly don't have CISOs or security folks. So I think if you're a security guy, security CISSP, and you're looking for something to do in early November, that's a pretty cool little volunteer project that I would highly recommend our brethren consider.
John Dixon, principal of the Denham Group, thank you so much once again for coming on and talking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
It was my pleasure, Paul. We'll be in touch.
John Dixon is a principal at the Denham Group. He was in the Security Ledger studios to talk with us about election security. Up next, when researchers at the University of Washington last July released a computer-manipulated video of former President Barack Obama saying things that the president had never said, the reaction was swift and filled with fear. With such technology, what kind of mischief could be unleashed in the heat of a political campaign or in the middle of a crisis? Thus far, applications of so-called deep fake technology have been confined to YouTube and that great testbed of all new internet technologies, the pornography industry. But our next guest, Michael Fawcett, the chief research officer at the firm G2 Crowd, worries that the real fun is just beginning as technology advancements enable more and more sophisticated deepfake forgeries. Such videos could destabilize already polarized societies that are prone to manipulation by misinformation. In order to fight deepfakes, Fawcett tells us, we will need new tools to identify fakes, as well as more action by platform owners to identify forgeries. I started off by asking Michael to talk about how he got interested in deepfake videos.
Michael Fawcett, and I'm the chief research officer of G2 Crowd. I got interested in this probably six months ago, and just through some of the research that we were doing around security and ransomware and enterprise kind of issues, dealing with different ways that technology can be used against them, and with all the hacks and everything, it's obviously a category we care a lot about. And I came across this this concept really that had evolved on Reddit. Probably no surprise there that in a subreddit, a developer had just thought, oh, this is an interesting concept. Could I build something that could swap faces on a video? Mm-hmm. And it started innocently enough that way. And the code, of course, incorporated some machine learning capabilities. And as AI does work, you train it over time, it improves, and it can improve quite quickly, actually. And he posted the code, and then, of course, other people took that open source code and they started working with it. And over a very short period of time, they started to produce these videos that swapped faces and emulated voice that looked fairly realistic. And I mean, that evolves very rapidly. You see some of the first ones, you could definitely tell, there's something funny about this, doesn't look exactly right. But then over a period of time, you start to see these and you go, if I was on my phone, particularly, would I really be able to tell the difference? And the truth is, no. In a 6 months or so period of time, I've been watching this, they have improved greatly, as AI-enabled software does, and it's not difficult to do.
As often happens on the internet, some of the first applications of this were in the realm of pornography, where you always early adopters of new technology, and where you had the faces of famous actresses generally, superimposed over existent pornographic video.
Yeah, absolutely. That's that was definitely the first application, and as you say, it's a pretty common place to test out technology, I guess.
The world's test bed.
It is the world's test bed. I mean, VR apparently is a big thing there, and I guess AI-enabled videos will be that too.
Yep. There we go. I guess harmless enough, although obviously if you're those actresses or actors, presumably, that's actually not that harmless to you and your reputation. What has changed, I guess, behind the scenes suddenly now in 2018 or 2017 that this type of manipulation is possible where it wasn't before? Is it just, as you said, the advancements of machine learning or the ability to access big compute clouds and clusters via Amazon Web Services and so on, or what?
Well, I mean, it's a convergence of several things. The biggest thing about AI, artificial intelligence is not really a new technology. It's been around for 20 or more years. And at one point, we called it analytics, and then we evolved that term. And we've gotten to the point of really talking about artificial intelligence. But the reason that artificial intelligence today is such a hot topic in business is more related to the data than it is to the technology. I mean, the technology is certainly getting better. And since it's technology that learns and improves itself, I guess it's improving itself as we work with it. But the data is, you know, I was talking to a data scientist not long ago about it, and he says that, you know, most AI applications are really 80 or 90% about the data and only, you know, 10, 20% about the technology, because you have to train AI to do whatever it is you need it to do. And that training is ongoing because it learns as it does something. And when it does those things, it improves. And so take that into, you know, into an environment where you get some code that goes into the wild and people start playing with it, and it can be exposed to a broad data set, which helps it learn. So, you know, it has YouTube, and I mean, there's any number of video sources today that you can play for an application, and sound is the same thing, right? You train in sound. So a lot of it is that convergence of the ability to get big sets of data to anywhere you want it very quickly, easily, and have technology that can then take advantage of that. And then, as you say, the underpinning of that, the cloud, the internet-enabled way that we do things today, just makes working with those big data sets and moving them around makes it very easy. It wouldn't have been easy 20 years ago, but today, you know, we talk about big data, which it's a phenomena, the ability to collect and move.
And we just this week, you know, kind of had the Democrats in the House Intelligence Committee release a whole tranche of Facebook ads trumpeting, you know, misleading information or fake news, whatever you want to call it. Security Ledger wrote today about, you know, Russian kind of information ops targeting, you know, Syrian humanitarian workers. This whole problem of computer-generated fake news is becoming a big one. How do we possibly combat it when we've got people debating whether a video is real? Most people really have been trained to sort of say, well, if there's video or pictures of it, then of course it's real.
Well, and I think that carries, you know, obviously we have a lot of good examples in the fake news end of it, true fake news, not fake news. It's a shame I have to make that distinction. But if you think about the implications there, and I think, you know, it is part of this whole problem, you know, with all of so many people online, so many people now very polarized in the way they look at things. And then, frankly, a large part of the population that does accept things that they see online in a much perhaps more open, easier way than people that might be a little more critical of that. It opens up some real dangerous possibilities with that. And, you know, in the timeliness of the way you do things and in the ability to release certain types of information, misinformation or disinformation to do voter suppression, to convince you that your candidate's going to win. So why bother to go vote, or to take people that are on the fence and give them a tiny bit of misinformation that plays to some emotional trigger that leads them across the line to the other side of that fence. I mean, all those things are important. And the timing, you know, the eve of an election, you see a video that's released of a candidate where the race is really close, and it's the candidate doing something that is very out of character, but it's something that causes a wave of public opinion against them and shifts an election. I mean, that is not an unreasonable scenario today at all.
I guess where does this leave us? So I mean, this, you know, we're still actually in the early days of, you know, deep fakes. Really, you know, a matter of a few months or a year that these types of convincing videos have been out there. But, you know, if we look at Moore's Law, right, we can pretty much count on the fact that these are going to become a lot more convincing and a lot harder to detect over time, and probably not that long a time. How do we inoculate ourselves? How do we build structures that keep us all grounded in what's truth before we all just start chasing after shadows that are phony baloney videos out there that are misleading us about the nature of reality?
I would like to be really optimistic and say that the real answer to that is that each individual has to become more critical of the information they view online and really understand the source. Now, unfortunately, I don't have any way to have that belief and propagate that through people that perhaps won't be that critical and haven't been in the past, and I don't have a reason to think they will be. So I mean, I think it's incumbent on the platforms to make it as easy as you can to understand the provenance of some video or ad you see. What's the source? is that a credible source? Is the individual that's responsible for it a source? I think, you know, individually, there are lots of things you could ask yourself.
Oh, yeah, people are really good at that, Michael. That's going to work out great.
I know, right? I start down this path, and every time I get really depressed.
Oh, yeah. That'll work well.
You and I will do that, and the rest of the population is in trouble. I don't, you know, unfortunately, that's the thing. So, I mean, there are other things that can happen. I mean, the platforms can help by giving you some ways to tell, but again, you have to want to tell, and that's a problem. There's a DARPA project initiative right now to come up with tools that, you know, media forensics is the program, and it's to come up with these tools that would help you immediately be able to identify those.
Right.
I mean, that's early stages, and it's not available today.
Yeah. You can see it kind of like maybe some kind of digital equivalent of what they do with currency or driver's license identity documents, right, where there will need to be some kind of hallmark or watermark on the file that would indicate its legitimacy.
Yeah, digital certificates. I mean, there are all kinds of things that are potential there. And then I think that, you know, that we have this gap, though, and hopefully the technology to respond to this, you end up in an arms race, and this is happening in security in general right now. You know, you have intelligent security that leads to intelligent hacking, and that leads to more intelligent security leads to intelligent. And I think the same thing is true in this case. You have these videos. We're now seeing reaction to try to come up with ways to find them, and forensics is the right answer there. It has to be that granular, and it's going to have to continue to evolve just like the videos do. And then in general, hopefully we can get the word out in some, you know, in some way to make people be more critical. And again, I'm not being optimistic there because I don't know how you impact the population to make them be more critical. But I think it's going to, you know, it could get scary before it gets better, I guess, is a simple bad way to say that.
I'm wondering if you're a political candidate, you know, in the midterms or, you know, looking ahead, and you're worried about this, is the answer to kind of a mutually assured destruction approach where, you know, you sort of have your deep fake videos stored away in case you need them. So that if somebody loses one on your candidate, you lose one on their candidate. And then before you know, the internet is full of convincing fake videos and it's a stalemate.
I think it's good for the write-in candidates maybe at that point. You wonder, right? It ends up in an arms race.
Yeah.
In the government, that's in the political arena, that's scary. In the general population and political situation around the world, the global situation, that could be scary. And frankly, even in business, there are scenarios I see there around manipulating businesses through manipulation of individuals in those businesses that could, you know, have repercussions for the economy. Yep. And I personally, I mean, you could certainly be blackmailed with a fake video as easily as you could with a real one, I think.
Yep.
So it's definitely a thing that's something people need to be aware of.
What's really scary is that you have this medium by which you could have somebody create a fake narrative, and now in this particular, you know, kind of in the zeitgeist that we have right now, you have politicians, you know, not naming names, but you have politicians who make it a habit of denying reality or spinning reality or just telling kind of bald-faced lies. And you do wonder, okay, well, if you have somebody who has a propensity for just denying kind of bald, you know, just sort of stating bald untruths, and then you have this video that's, you know, kind of propagating these untruths, gosh, that could be a really toxic brew.
It can, and unfortunately, that the behavior that you're talking about has created even more polarization among different parts of the population. And so you want to believe the fake more than you want to believe the real. That ends up being a significant problem. But I do think that it's important that we get the message out that this is available, this is happening, and it is believable. It's just like the Cambridge Analytica psychometric issue that happened with Facebook. you know, we knew about this 2 years ago or more, and it has been happening for a while, but it was only known about among a niche group of people. It wasn't known in the general population. And I think until that happens, until you know that it's possible that that's not real, it's too easy to believe that it is. And so I feel like we have some obligation to get that word out.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like there's this disjunction between what people who are within the technology community or sort of subject matter experts within these areas recognize is possible and, in fact, already happening, and then just this kind of general awareness out there amongst the policymaking community or the regulatory community or just people at large. So these things come along and all of a sudden people are blindsided by them, and you've got this small group of people being like, oh yeah, we were talking about that 2 years ago, you know, like we're not surprised. And it's sort of like, well, if we knew about it 2 years ago, I guess what could we have done or should we have done that we didn't? Because obviously the way things panned out was not in anybody's interest.
Well, and in general population, we want to believe that change is linear. You want to believe that what you see today is changing in the same incremental way it continues in the future. Mm-hmm. But what happens with technology is it's not linear at all. It's exponential. And so we don't realize how short the gaps are between what's happening and what's possible today and what's going to be possible in the future. And I think people get confused or fooled by that.
Michael Fauchette of G2 Crowd, thank you so much for coming on the Security Ledger podcast and talking to us. It was a real pleasure.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you inviting me, and certainly a nice, enjoyable conversation.
Michael Fauchette is the chief research officer at the firm G2 Crowd. He was here talking to the Security Ledger podcast about deep fakes.